So welcome everyone to the Many Rules of Film Club. This is Jeff Yance. I'm the program director at the Loft Cinema, and we also have with us occasional filmmaker Heather Lattis.
Hello.
And multimedia artist Rusty Boulay Stevenson.
You people are going to be sorry if I don't get my cha-cha shoes.
That's a great teaser. One of the best lines.
Yeah.
From a John Waters film, because today we're celebrating and discussing John Waters, the Prince of Puke, the Sultan of Sleaze, the King of Trash, which are all titles that I would love to hold. So I totally respect him and love him as a filmmaker.
You're not disparaging him with those titles.
Those are not disparaging titles at all. Those are definitely commendable.
He encourages those.
Yes, exactly. So we're going to talk about John Waters, and I think the relevance of this right now is just that John Waters is actually in theaters now. One of his first films has been re-released to theaters called Multiple Maniacs from 1970. It was one of his very first films, shot on 16mm. It has now been restored by the Criterion Collection and has been now reconfigured as an art film, which I find hilarious. And wonderful and great. And I think John Waters said, great, now my movie looks like a bad John Cassavetes film, which I always which I always wanted it to look like.
That's very true, actually.
So trash has become art, and I think we're all the better for it. So we're just going to talk about some of our favorite John Waters flicks. And perhaps the best place to start is at the beginning.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. So I was going to just talk a little bit about one of my favorites. It's actually a twofer, Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble, 1972 and 1974. I think obviously Pink Flamingos is the one that put John Waters on the map. He obviously wanted to shock people, get people's attention, and he succeeded beyond, I think, anyone's wildest dreams. If you've seen Pink Flamingos, you're forever changed by it. I think you can't unsee it, for sure. A comedy, I think some people would debate like how hilarious it is. I find it hilarious. Not everyone does.
No,
they didn't find it hilarious.
Occasionally.
Yeah. So basically, for those who are not informed about Pink Flamingos, it's a film starring Divine. It was one of the big first films he did with Divine. She and her family are competing with a couple of criminals slash perverts called the Marbles for the distinction of the filthiest people alive, because why not? That's a title that no one wants, and right. So Pink Flamingos is going to do it. And this movie thus then includes I think pretty much every conceivable perversion one could imagine. I think incest, cannibalism, bestiality, on and on.
Kidnapping.
Forced pregnancy.
Feces eating.
Yes. Coprophilia, I think we like to call it.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know it has an official name.
Yeah, that's the fancy word for it. But that's what kind of made Pink Flamingos famous, I think, is the dog poop eating sequence.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Which has not been topped, I think, in terms of sheer, unadulterated horror.
Disgust.
Yeah.
Can't unsee it.
Yeah, I started thinking about what would top it. I don't want to think about that.
No, you didn't. No, actually, you don't.
No, I don't.
Yeah. And it's great that, you know, this many years on, you know, almost 40 years on, it still disturbs people and still shocks people. And that's what's John Waters' goal, to get attention. And much like the surrealists like Dali and Duchamp, I mean, that's the goal, is to shock complacency, bourgeois norms. And that's what Pink Flamingos did. It was very punk, which is why I love it. It's very punk. It's very kind of anti-authority, anti-conformism, anti-conservative values.
Things that would mark John Waters' career throughout all of his films.
Yes, exactly.
He carried those themes always.
All the way through. Yes, with less extremity around it, but always with the same kind of core idea,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I find it hilarious. I love the cast of weird characters. Edie, the grandmother in the playpen who loves the eggs, the egg lady. Love her.
I could not. I mean, like, love I wanted her. To love her, but.
Yeah, and then as a bookend, Female Trouble, which came out a couple years later, really a showcase for Divine. Because Divine, I think, really is what makes Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble.
Just and that, Female Trouble, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Just that great, kind of crazy, over-the-top bold, like that drag persona at that point was really radical, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, really kind of shocking and kind of grotesque.
The early mid-70s, that was not around a lot. I mean, at least not in mainstream at all. Not that these films were mainstream. They weren't.
Right.
But, but he was trying to, I think, show it off. I mean, he borrows from Kenneth Anger, who was a filmmaker, who was kind of the first openly homosexual filmmaker, is what I've read. And it's kind of interesting. He's got a movie, Fireworks, that's fairly short, that I think John Waters borrows a lot from and built upon.
Yeah.
Built upon that that theme, I guess.
Well, and Divine was never trying to pass, like...
Oh, no.
No, I mean, this was full in your face, you know, drag, you know.
Yeah. Divine, I think, was so great, wanted you to notice that he was different. Mm-hmm. It was not about fitting in. It was about standing out and being outside the mark, about outside of being outside of mainstream society.
That's what John Waters wants, too.
Yeah.
Right? I think I watched a few of his films gearing up for this, and there are times when I think he purposefully... Maybe there's an interview in Cecil B. Demented where the lady's holding the microphone, but she's not holding it anywhere close to the person's mouth. It's way back close to her body. And I think it's almost purposefully done. In another movie, they would try to make that real. John Waters is fine with that not seeming real and with that seeming outlandish.
Right.
Like John, like Divine. Divine wasn't trying to really look like a woman.
Or a man.
Yeah, right. No. And so I think that John Waters does that with his films in general. And Divine was kind of that complete expression of it in one person.
Right. And does it with, you know, a good kind of fun, dark sense, albeit dark sense of humor. If you're on his wavelength. If not, you'll just run screaming from the theater. I mean,
Female Trouble is hilarious. Divine is hilarious in Female Trouble.
That's, I think, the best Divine performance. It's like a big melodrama. Yeah. You know, she follows her career as a criminal, and she ends up going to the electric chair at the end of the film, and she gets to kill her own daughter, who becomes a Hare Krishna. And it's pretty amazing. And also very punk. She gets the mohawk and she gets the acid in her face, so she's all burned up. And it's kind of an ugly film in a lot of ways, but it's really funny. And I think that's due to Divine and that kind of great dialogue and all the great lines and the weird set design. Very campy. It's very much like 60s camp pop culture kind of referencing. And what I think is funny about those early films, they, like Pink Flamingos in particular, became a cult film. It was one of the original midnight movies, and people go see it stoned, which probably, you know,
made it funnier.
Probably made it funnier. Yeah. We did not so long ago show that at the Loft, and we served dog poop cookies, which I thought was funny.
Oh, that's great.
Which were very realistic to the point where people were worried about eating them because they weren't sure that they were actually edible cookies. But the movie still had the power to shock people. Like, people were still leaving the theater, and they said,
I love that.
"Oh, this isn't the guy who did Hairspray, right?"
That's
the guy who did Hairspray. So John Waters has gotten a little more mainstream, but not ever totally mainstream. So Rusty, I think you were interested in talking about Crybaby, which is sort of his first big mainstream motion picture.
Yeah, it's his first movie where he had millions and millions of dollars to make it. He put Johnny Depp, who was a teen idol, he said he went and bought all these teen magazines, and Johnny Depp was on the cover of all of them. And Johnny Depp took the role because he didn't want to be typecast as this teen idol. And so the movie makes fun of 50s nostalgia a little bit, and still wallows in it a touch too, still loves the 50s nostalgia, absolutely, but rather than the heroes being the squares are the heels of the bad guys, the antagonists to Crybaby, who's a drape. He's the leader of the drapes, which is a term at the time I wasn't familiar with. I guess there were real drapes, was a group in Baltimore.
Yeah.
Which is where John Waters makes all of his movies. He's from Baltimore, and he makes all of his movies are all set in Baltimore.
Right.
And so this is set in 1950s Baltimore, and Crybaby's Johnny Depp, and he falls for Allison, who's kind of the queen of the squares.
And she wants to be a scrape.
And she, yeah, she wants to be
square
a scrape.
And a drape.
She wants to be both. Yes. She doesn't understand why there have to be these demarcations saying you're either a square or a drape. The music's amazing in it. Dave Alvin of the Alvin Brothers and the Blasters, right?
Yep.
He was the music supervisor, and it really shows. He wrote a couple of the songs, King Crybaby. Which, Jeff, when you were on my show, The Current, we played King Crybaby. That was really great.
I love it, yeah.
Yeah, it was one of my favorites to get to play.
Yeah.
And so the music's really great. It's a lot of fun. When I watched it as a 16-year-old. I went to the theater. I had never heard of John Waters. I had maybe seen bits and pieces of something of his, maybe in cable. But I went in not knowing what I was about to see, and I left thinking, well, that was just a bad movie. But what happened is I thought about it still for days later. I still found myself thinking about the songs, thinking about Johnny Depp in this funny role, you know, and how odd it was. And a couple years later, I saw it on cable, and when I saw that it was going to be on cable, I was excited. I no longer thought of it as just a bad movie. Instead, I understood the camp somehow better. And certainly by the time I watched it on cable, I was loving Crybaby. I absolutely loved the film.
Yeah.
And what John Waters did there is he turned all of those conventions upside down. He made this mainstream film, but he made you cheer for the drapes. And the drapes were Iggy Pop is in the movie, and he's great. The cast is absolutely phenomenal.
Susan Tyrell. Yeah, there's so many good people.
There's so many good people in that movie. Tracy Lords is in it, and Patty Hearst is in it. Ricky Nelson's in it. Tracy Lords was actually investigated. The FBI came onto the set of the movie because she was an underage porn actor. Right. And so they were coming to question her about that at the time during the making of Crybaby, which I think is interesting. But John Waters has always had his finger on the pulse, and he's, I think, years ahead of his time. Crybaby is still a very watchable film, very entertaining, and still kind of cutting edge.
Still kind of weird and subversive.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of strangeness in it when she collects her tears in a jar and then drinks them.
And then drinks it.
Yeah. Oh. It's like, wow, this is a PG musical from Universal Pictures. And odd. So he always maintained, even with high production values, the weirdness.
And women taking control of their sexuality as well.
Mm-hmm.
You see some of that with Allison, I feel like, in particular. And so there's just a ton to like about Crybaby. It's rated PG, and I showed it to my 7-year-old, and he really enjoyed it. I mean, we were laughing and having a good time. It might not be for every 7-year-old. I just like to get a disclaimer for any parent who might be listening. You might watch it first to make sure it's going to be appropriate for your 7-year-old.
Exactly.
But John Waters would have a 7-year-old watch it. John Waters was very much in. I mean, he would go and watch porn movies when he was a little kid at the drive-ins, right? And he'd have binoculars, is what I've read, and watch the pornos at the drive-in.
Yeah. And again, if you're on his wavelength, I mean, this is obviously a campy sort of satire of Elvis Presley movies from the 60s. So he knows that they're kind of hokey.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
But sometimes that's a hard wavelength to get on and understand that it's deliberately campy and not just bad.
That's right. My son, it was funny to hear him because I was like, I told him the same story about me going as a high school kid going to watch it and thinking, oh, this is a bad movie. And my 7-year-old is like, well, have you ever heard the phrase, it's so bad, it's good?
Oh,
I was like,
he gets it.
I have heard that phrase, son. That's great stuff right there. In fact, and he totally noticed that Johnny Depp was lip syncing. John Waters doesn't try to hide that anymore, like you said, than they tried to hide it necessarily with the Elvis movies.
No.
And so John Waters kind of revels in that, in the fact that I don't do things conventionally. It doesn't necessarily look like every movie. There's going to be overacting, and some of the scenes aren't really going to make sense. You know, in reality, they wouldn't make sense, like the drinking of the tears and a lot of the stuff. The making of the license plates was pretty great in the movie. Johnny Depp's in juvenile detention and making license plates that all say Allison.
It's a gritty, realistic drama, obviously. But somewhat sad that this was the first post-Divine film for John Waters. So there's that kind of energy was missing from that point on, the Divine energy. But he did replace it with that kind of the slicker kind of like more mainstream sensibility that was still kind of odd.
Yeah.
But I think it is noticeable that Divine is not involved.
Yeah.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. And the previous film, Hairspray, still had Divine, and that was kind of his first step into the mainstream, I guess.
First time a lot of people saw Divine. Then I was like,
yes.
What?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And playing a much less kind of crazy, vicious character is playing a nice mm-hmm. mother in the film. Yeah, just a mom. A Baltimore mom.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I guess we should also say rest in peace to Kim McGuire, who played Hatchet Face in Crybaby, mm-hmm. recently passed away.
Hatchet Face.
Hatchet Face. And she was a great John Waters person. Mm-hmm. She had that face and that great delivery. Like, she was well-versed in the John Waters delivery.
Yeah, you almost expected to see her in more of his films. It was kind of weird that that was the only one.
I'm always surprised she didn't make more films.
Yeah.
Him. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she was great. And we will miss Hatchet Face. But then John Waters started getting, I think, subversive again. And we started moving away from the big studio films. And that takes us to Cecil B. DeMented, which I think, Heather, you really like.
Yes. I loved Cecil B. DeMented because it's... makes fun of the movie industry, and anything that makes fun of the movie industry is usually good.
It's fine by me.
If you can't have some self-reflexive moments, you know, brought along with extreme violence, what can you have, you know? But yeah, Cecil B. DeMented is from 2000. It's his second to the last movie after, it was right before Dirty Shame. And it stars Melanie Griffith, and she plays this Hollywood aging starlet who gets kidnapped by these rogue guerrilla filmmakers led by Stephen Dorff. And Honey Whitlock is Melanie Griffith's name, which is like such a great aging starlet name.
Yeah.
And Stephen Dorff, he's a great character actor. So, I mean, you totally buy that he's into this auteur, that I am the director. He calls himself Cecil B. DeMented. You know, his homage, all of the guerrilla filmmaker crew has tattoos that pay homage to various hardcore extreme directors like Peckinpah and Anger and all of those other ones.
Fassbender.
Yes.
David Lynch is on Knuckles.
Yes.
Yeah, it's all very hilarious. And noted that it's in 2000 and it was that, you know, they were in the movie, they invade one of the sets of Forrest Gump 2. I mean, they call it Gump 2 or something. And I mean, it's like...
Gump really, Again.
Yeah,
isn't
Gump
it?
Again. Or, yeah. I mean, and Kevin Nealon's supposed to play. Like, it's made a mockery of the whole Hollywood system on one hand because, you know, the whole idea of the big blockbuster, you know, it opens with, you know, a marquee of a theater and it's Star Wars, Star Wars, Star Wars, and Star Trek, Star Trek, Star Trek. So, and it was around the time the first Star Wars was remade, the very first one, and well, not remade, but you know what I mean. So it was all about going against that big blockbuster kind of idea, and the fact that, you know, the idea of a sequel without the original lead actor, like making fun of that kind of thing with Kevin Nealon being Tom Hanks' character. And it's just, if you've ever have been involved in any sort of filmmaking, you kind of get it because, you know, there are these filmmakers who they all have their roles and they're kind of in the stereotypical filmmaking roles.
Right.
And it's just such a, it's a commentary on that. But then on the flip side, it's a commentary on indie filmmaking because I really feel like in the 2000 era, like probably late 90s to the 2000s, the indie filmmaking industry was like so hardcore and sticking to their principles about certain filmmaking ideas.
Like Dogma.
Yeah, like Dogma 95 and stuff like that. And so I think that's also him making fun of that because Stephen Dorff's character, Cecil B. DeMented, is like, you know, no, we're all celibate to the end of the film. Like nobody has sex and there's like this high sex energy around the set where everyone wants to have sex with each other.
They're all very horny. And one take only.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is like the most ridiculous thing. Like Honey Whitlock says, there's no safety, no coverage. And you're like, we don't believe in that. Ruins the integrity. Like, what do you mean it ruins integrity?
Which is the great joke of Cecil B. DeMented because the movie they are making is going to be terrible.
It's going to be horrible. There's no coverage. There's like bad stunts, bad acting. It's hilarious.
Poorly composed shots just on the fly.
Yeah. Right. And but because it's indie, they think it's going to be great simply because it's independent.
Right.
And they're so fierce about it.
Yes, simply because they're sticking to their principles that it's going to automatically be good, which is a ludicrous idea. But many a filmmaker has made a movie on that. So So it's sort of making fun of both sides. And I totally appreciate it. I feel like John Waters has that feeling where nothing can't be made fun of. And so he's hitting both sides. He's hitting the Hollywood and mainstream, and then he's hitting the independent side. And so it's interesting. And I think that it's worth noting that. So
do you think he's making fun of himself a little bit, too?
I'm sure definitely. I hope so.
Right?
I think,
Cecil B. Demented could be John Waters.
I think that could be one of his nicknames.
Well, yeah, it could be a nickname. Yeah. It really could have been.
Some of them were saying, I can't remember what movie, but some of the actors were saying that he can be very intense as a director, depending on which movie you were in. But so I think, he was definitely making fun of, himself to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And Cecil B. Demented will always be one of my favorite John Waters because it makes fun of what I love, which is filmmaking, and it brings it into a movie and then makes fun of blockbusters, which is awesome.
And which is great. Itself,
I mean, sure, Forrest Gump had its moments, but it's also, on another hand, like ridiculous if you really think about it. So
and it ends with Melanie Griffith on top of a drive-in with her hair on fire.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good ending for film.
Yeah. It's very, even the guerrilla filmmakers, they call him their sprockets. So, there are sprocket holes on film. So it's very, kitschy filmmaker. Like, maybe only a filmmaker would know that, but it's all around and all encompassing in that movie. So I appreciated it for that. And he had some of his old school characters. Ricky Lake was in there. And Patty Hearst played one of the moms, the guerrilla filmmakers. It's definitely.
And the movie really almost is like her story. Yes. I mean, Melanie Griffith is playing a Patty Hearst-like character.
It's Stockholm Syndrome.
Right.
Because
she starts to buy into the whole idea that, Hollywood is BS and it's just a bunch, it's just a machine and that kind of thing. So she kind of goes along with it. And
she gets branded.
Right. Well, that's the whole hardcore thing. They all get branded with the Cecil B. DeMille brand, which is ridiculous. But if you were ever a young filmmaker, being a young filmmaker with low budget, you're there all kinds of hours, dedicating your time, usually for free. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of is that mentality of, and I'm sure John Waters remembered that, making Pink Flamingo and, and all of those things so hardcore. And at the time, you're because you don't have a lot of resources, you believe in it so much because that's what gets you through it.
Yeah.
And so, but to look back and then to also make fun of that, because why not? Let's make fun of it and make fun of feeling so like this film's so important.
Yeah. And I feel like being in a John Waters movie is like being in a cult because you really have to buy into his philosophy because it's a very strange worldview that he has.
Yeah.
And you have to totally buy into it.
When it's like, a cult. It's not a direct quote, but he wants to make fun of the things that make people feel uncomfortable. And I think if you're not on board with that, you are going to feel so uncomfortable, you may walk out of the movie theater. And I mean, I'm totally on board, so it's fine. I'm willing to be uncomfortable and sit through it if it's a John Waters movie.
Well, speaking of discomfort, though, this was after Crybaby, which was his big mainstream film. And then he still made studio films, but they got a lot darker. There's a scene in Cecil B. Demented where the cinema terrorists, they call themselves, attack a movie theater showing Patch Adams.
The director's cut.
The director's cut of Patch Adams, which is great. And I remember at the time when I saw it in the theater, I kind of cheered a little bit. Yeah, I get Patch Adams. But they're storming into this theater with guns and terrorizing the audience and telling them, get out of here, and throwing gas cans at them. And today, the landscape has changed quite a bit. Now, that scene now reads in a different way.
It definitely does.
Right, and I think John Waters would still do it, but
I think so.
It wouldn't fly like it did in 2000.
Yeah, and that's the thing with John Waters. I think he's often been a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of dicey material.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly Pink Flamingos and that whole kind of trash aesthetic really sort of got absorbed by the mainstream with the Farrelly brothers and There's Something About Mary. And those kind of films. And like in Cecil B. Demented, that scene, I think, really sort of prefigured what was going on with violence in movie theaters.
Right. And I mean, the violence is over the top, and you don't really think about the effect of it. And of course, it's to the extreme and to the campiness and all of that. But you can't forget that it does have an effect on the audience, whether you're trying to play it straight or trying to play it campy.
Right.
Oh, I had not seen it until we were preparing for this podcast. And it definitely, seeing them come in with guns now is a different feeling than it would have been in the year 2000. It really is.
Right.
There's no two ways about it. One thing I want to say is I really love the movie Serial Mom. Mm. That was one that maybe it's my favorite John Waters. It's maybe his best film in some ways in that it tells a really cohesive story. It's fairly well made. But the opening sequence of Serial Mom is almost what John Waters is doing with film in general, where you're following this fly. And you're in a suburban home with a suburban family, and it's all pristine and nice, except this fly really shows you that everything here is not as clean and not as pristine. And that's what John Waters is doing, is he's putting these trash movies into malls. And suburban families are going to see Crybaby and Serial Mom and Cecil B. Demented. Mm-hmm. And that's so amazing. I think that in and of itself is really a really great thing that he's done for film.
And a true subversive in that sense.
Yes.
That he has not sold out. People say he's sold out because he's not doing Pink Flamingos anymore.
He hasn't sold out, no.
But it's much more subversive to get, as you said, suburban families to go see these movies.
Yeah.
And still have your message in there. And then I guess just kind of to wrap this up, and we're talking earlier about how John Waters has not made a feature film since A Dirty Shame in 2004, which was slapped with an NC-17 rating. It's kind of an incredible movie thematically because it's all about sex addicts who all have different sex perversions. And I remember John Waters was talking about him trying to get an R rating for it, and the ratings board said, well, there's no explicit sex in the film. There's no nudity, actually, either. But there's all pervasive perversity, and there's no way you could get an R rating for that. And that's kind of where America is now. Just like even the idea of sex is so horrifying. So it got an NC-17 rating, so it really kind of reduced its audience and didn't make money. And so he says at this point he can't get funding to make films anymore. He's had several projects in the works, and no one will fund his movies, which is a little sad for someone of his stature and, you know, his kind of cultural importance.
Well, and I think that can't be understated. I think his cultural importance will only grow over time. Mm. 30 years from now, John Waters is going to be more acclaimed than he is today. I feel certain of that. I feel certain that most of his films, like you say, he's made this stuff mainstream. He's made cheering on the outcasts mainstream, right? And that's what Crybaby did. That's what Crybaby did.
Even Hairspray.
And Hairspray. Oh, absolutely Hairspray.
Yeah.
Hairspray is really great. And Hairspray and Crybaby have both been made musicals that played on Broadway and were nominated for Tonys.
Yeah, and Hairspray was a lot about integration and race issues and also the empowerment of a plus-size young woman that you never would see as a heroine of a film.
Yeah.
Never.
I mean, that's all pretty forward-thinking.
Yeah.
Stuff.
I mean, I think he has so many more stories to tell that would be challenging us even today if someone would give him a little cash.
Just give him some money.
Give him some money. Make some more movies.
And he's a fabulous writer. He writes books.
Great writer.
He's a photographer. He does art shows. And he still does a lot of things, but I think we miss him making movies.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, God. I think he would do amazing things with current society things right now. So, yes, definitely.
Well, and making stuff that will be profound 20 years from now, and that would be still groundbreaking. I'm sure he would still be doing that. I just think we should talk a little bit about what he's done. I mean, he wrote a book about hitchhiking. He's been fascinated with hitchhiking for most of his life, it seems like. And so he did a cross-country hitchhiking adventure and wrote about it. You guys have both read the book, right?
It's hilarious.
It's hilarious.
I laughed out loud reading it many times. It's
in
a great
public
read.
Places, you say.
In public places. I had no shame. He was hilarious.
Yeah. And that's a fantastic book. There's also another new book called Role Models that he did recently, which is about people who have influenced him. And he talks about, you know, one of the Manson family members, Patricia Van Houten, whom he worked very hard to get out of prison because he wanted her to be. He knew that she was rehabilitated. So that's a whole issue about him believing in the rehabilitation of criminals. And he talks about that in the book, but in a funny kind of accessible way. So it doesn't feel like a heavy handed message.
Yeah.
When that's such a progressive idea. I mean, that's kind of lost in America. We don't rehabilitate our prisoners at all, by and large. We do offer education, but we don't really rehabilitate. We don't believe in that
DIY
almost.
It's DIY in prison.
Yeah, it's do it yourself.
You're not gonna get you. I mean, agreed.
Yeah.
And so that's a really progressive notion. And that's, again, part of what he's always done is he's seen these outcasts and been like, no, no, you're my people. You're my dreamlanders. You're right. going to be part of my group now, right. you outcasts.
Right.
And he's turned people into huge stars. Ricky Lake. He introduced the world to Ricky Lake. That's kind of amazing to me.
Exactly. Yeah. And kind of brought Patricia Hearst, kind of normalized her life, like brought her back from being a tabloid figure into being kind of a mainstream celebrity, which was kind of great because he also championed her and her rehabilitation, that she was not a criminal, that she was actually kidnapped and, you know, kind of like Cecil B. DeMented. As we said, that was sort of her story. So I think people would not assume that he would have those kind of very progressive political views. But when you watch the movies, even though they're shocking, some of them, they're very progressive, very forward thinking.
Generally speaking, yes. I think Hairspray in particular, in dealing with integration and the way that it does. My son and I watched the musical version, which is great. And John Waters is in it. He's a flasher at the very beginning. But my son really understood the message of the movie so much, or the messages of the movie, female empowerment, and that we're all the same and every day should be Negro Day, not just one day a week. Right. Like, my son really understood that at the age of seven. He understood that sense of justice.
Yeah. It shouldn't just be the last Tuesday of every month.
Yeah.
Like on Hairspray.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even the old films like Pink Flamingos, the idea of identity politics, do what you want, be who you want to be, that is still extremely relevant today, and it's still contentious.
Mm-hmm.
Even today, we can't quite wrap our minds around that, even though the trans community has been making huge leaps forward. But that he was doing that 40 years ago, advocating that message. And so that's, I don't know, it's pretty amazing.
Before people knew it should be a message.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, no, John Waters has really been a groundbreaking filmmaker. And it's easy to, I think, to look at his stuff and say he's just this genre filmmaker and it's trash and there's not a lot of redeeming quality. I don't believe that at all. I think that, again, he's going to be considered one of the best filmmakers of this generation.
Agreed. And please come back and start making movies, John Waters. We'll all go see them.
Okay. Netflix, we're looking at you.
Yeah. Yes, go to Netflix. Yeah. Well, that's great. Okay, so thanks, Rusty and Heather. That was very fun. So next week, we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic, quality films that lost money at the box office, which leads us to rule number 907 of the Many Rules of Film Club, is that there's box office and there's quality, and often never the twain shall meet.
Sadly.
Amen. Sadly. So thanks again, and we'll see you next time on the Many Rules of Film Club.